we're going to talk about today is the idea of davening for one who is sick, the idea of being mispalel for a chole. Unfortunately, we encounter this experience quite often. We have friends, we have relatives, we have loved ones who are not well. And I thought it was an important idea to discuss exactly how one is supposed to properly daven for he or she who might be sick. So let's begin with the following. There's a comment made in the Ramah in Yerideya where he quotes the Ramban. And to many this is a surprising comment, but this is the way the Shulchan Aruch explains the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. So we have a mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, and Bikur Cholim is an all-encompassing mitzvah. It means not only do I have an obligation to be mevaker, to go and visit, but Rav Hutner writes in the Pachad Yitzchak that levaker in Hebrew also means a bikur, bikoret, you have to do an investigation. So when you go to be mevaker chole, it means you don't only visit them and try to lift their spirits, but you also have to investigate to make sure that all of their needs are being met. Are their medical needs being met? Do they have the food that they need? Do they have all the things that a chole might need in order to make themselves be on the road to recovery? So bikur cholem is a very important mitzvah. And yet the Ramban, as quoted in the Ramah, explains that what is the essence, what is the heart of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim? It is not what you think. It's not to go there and to lift the spirits of the chole. That's a part of it. It is not to go there and provide the chole with everything they might need. That is also just a part of the mitzvah. The essence of the mitzvah, says the Ramban, that kala mevaker es hachole. If you are mevaker es hachole, I forgot to put it on here, below bikish al avrachamim, and you have left the presence of the chola without asking, without offering a tefillah to the Ribono Shel Olam on behalf of that person who is ill, lo kiyei mitzvaso. You have not fulfilled your obligation of bikur cholim, which is something very surprising to us, because how often do we go to visit someone, and the furthest thing from our mind is to go and offer a tefillah while we're there. But really that is the heart, that is the essence of the mitzvah of bikur cholim, is to give oneself an opportunity to offer a tefillah on behalf of he or she who might be ill, who needs a refuah. That is something very important. Where does this idea come from? So we have a Gemara in Moed Katan Daf Hei, where the Gemara says, Tameh Tameh Yikra, that anybody who has a tsar, anyone who is going through a difficult experience, a difficult time, either health-wise or otherwise, so the Gemara says, Tzarech Shiyodiyo L'Rabim, there is an idea that one should share that pain with others, not just to alleviate oneself from the inner turmoil that they're going through while they try to work through the issue, but also that people should be able to see, that people should ask for rachmanis. It's important that when we have an individual concern, when we have something that is of distress to us, we share it with others in order that they should have the opportunity to also offer a tefillah on behalf of our predicament. And this is what the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos as well, that when one has a situation where you have a field, and let's say my parnasa comes from being a farmer, and this year my farms did not grow well, so the Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos that I should paint the trees with red dye, with red paint, in order that anybody who passes by, that's the code word, go and be mispalel, go and offer a tefillah, because I don't have a good parnasa this year. This is a very important thing, the Gemara says, that one should share their difficulties, their challenges with others, in order that others should be able to be mispalel on their behalf. And here the Ramah writes as well, when it comes to Bikur Cholim, you have the chola lying in the bed. That's the code word for the person to understand that they must offer a tefillah on behalf of the chola, and if that tefillah is not offered, Bikur Cholim has not been fulfilled in its proper sense. So that's a very important halacha to be aware of. Sometimes we have a situation where a chola is sick for an extended period of time. And you have, in this extended period of time, you can have the close family members are coming every day or are coming all the time to offer a tefillah, and you'll say, well, obviously, God is not interested in my tefillah. If I've offered a tefillah once, and then again, and then I keep coming back, and every time I offer a tefillah, and I go home at night, and I'm offering it to Tehillim, how much should I be offering a tefillah? Isn't it a little bit unfair to keep doing that to God? After all, He obviously does not have an interest in hearing my tefillah. He doesn't want to give this person a refuah. So what exactly is the understanding with the practice that we have, that we daven, and we daven over again for a situation that we want help with? So over here, Rav Shimshon Pinkus explains as follows. Very beautifully, he suggests that when the Gemara tells us about Hamifalo Velo Nene, on the first line here, the Gemara says that when you have somebody who offers a tefillah Velo Nene, and they feel that they weren't answered, they ask for a refuah for a family member, and they see that the person is still as sick as they were before. Yachzor v'yispalo, says the Gemara, you go back and you daven again. So what does that mean, you go back and you daven again? Why should I go back and daven again? I did what I can do. I asked God to help out and to cure the person from their illness. Now he's not interested in listening. Why am I going back and davening yet again? Ein zeh, says Rav Pinkus, ein zeh rak inyan shel yispalel pam nosefes. This is not an idea that I should go ahead and just offer the tefillah again. She'ulai teitev ha'tefillah hashniya meharishona, because maybe the first time when I davened, I didn't have the requisite kavana. Maybe the first time when I davened, I didn't say all the words. Maybe I didn't realize a particular paragraph in the davening. That's not why you daven again. O misiba acheres she'ulai yirtzehu Hashem. It's not because maybe this time I'll butter up to God more and maybe He'll listen to me this time, even though He didn't listen last time. Rather, he says what it means is, elohu dome lechofer habor. This is similar to someone who's digging a pit. And you have to clear a big empty space in order to let the tub in that you want to insert into the ground. Shachofer chafira afer chafira. You have to come to work every day and put the shovel in and keep digging. Pechol chafira, and every time you put the shovel in and dig out dirt, misalekes odafer, you're able to remove a little bit more of the dirt. Adshe misrachev umis amekabor, until ultimately after doing this day after day, you're going to have a wide and deep pit that you originally intended to have. Adji Roy Leos base kibel, until it's able to have a space which is open to put in whatever you wanted to enter. This is the same thing. Don't think when one offers a tefillah for a chola or for any need that a person has, a parnasa, a yeshua, whatever it might be, so you say, I davened already, God heard me. Why does the Gemara tell me to daven again? Don't think it's because, oh, maybe you'll do a better job the second time than the first. You had a heartfelt tefillah the first time, you're going to have it the second time again. There's nothing more about the second tefillah than the first. You know what the difference is? The difference is that you're trying to reach a particular goal. And by putting the shovel into the ground and digging out again and digging out again, ultimately you'll have that big hole. Ultimately you'll be able to penetrate and you'll be able to get what you want. And that's what he explains over here. When you do chatziva acher chatziva, pam acher pam, when a person does offer a tefillah, one time and another time and then again, ad shetiskabel bakasha senu, until our bakasha is accepted. So he says that is the understanding that we should have in this Gemara. And he says the same way that a worker has to come to their job, to their profession, with all the tools that are necessary, so too he says we come with our bakashas, we come with our tefillah, we come with our demos, we come with our heart, we come with our feelings, we come with our emotions, and we offer all of that to dig and to dig once again until finally we reach that which we are looking forward to getting from the Ribono Shel Olam on, as a result, as a merit of our tefillah. So what's interesting to note is that there is no one particular for a tefillah that one offers. Let's say you're Mevaker Chola. So sometimes people ask, what am I supposed to say? There's no sitter that says, when you go visit someone who's sick in the hospital, say X or say Y. So what exactly is one supposed to say? So this is an interesting question. We find, if you look in the Chumash, Moshe Rabbeinu has two different experiences of tefillah. One time Moshe Rabbeinu has the unfortunate circumstance of his sister being sick. And Moshe Rabbeinu offers a tefillah that consists of how many words? 5. That's the whole tefillah. Kael na refa na la. It's 5 words. All he asks is that God should please have mercy and grant a refuah. He doesn't even say who it's for. He doesn't say anything. No descriptive detail about anything in that tefillah, and yet it worked. And then again, Moshe Rabbeinu, on a different occasion in his life, offers a tefillah for 40 days in a row that the Jewish people should not be destroyed. So sometimes, the Rishonim point out, sometimes one has to offer a tefillah, just 5 words is going to do the trick. Sometimes one has to offer a tefillah where you need 40 days, you need a very extensive period of being mispalel and being mislin, of putting oneself out in front of the Ribono Shel Olam, in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and asking Him day after day, with that shovel, with that axe, and making sure that you just keep on doing it over and over again. There is no one formula to know what exactly one should or should not say. Whatever you feel connects you to the Ribono Shel Olam is good enough. And that's what some point out, that Moshe Rabbeinu, on the occasion of Yetzias Mitzrayim, he's standing in front of the river, and everybody's crying and everyone's screaming, and God says, Ma titzak elai, why are you crying out to me? Why are you praying to me? Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yiso, it's time for them to plow forward. It's time for them to walk through the Nile, through the river. Let them cross the Yamsuf. So when you read that pasuk, it's a very surprising pasuk. God says, why are you crying to me? Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yiso. Isn't it obvious? Why aren't they walking through the water? I wouldn't have thought that was obvious. I would not have instructed a whole few million people to start walking through the water. But yet God said that should be what's expected, that everybody should know that's what they're supposed to do. So some Rishonim write that, what does it mean Ma tzitzak elai, some say it means, it's a reference to Moshe Rabbeinu's times when he davened. Number one, he davens mem yom, some ma, the word ma is sometimes mem yom, and the hey is five words. Sometimes your tefillah is 40 days, sometimes your tefillah is five words, but right now God says none of this is appropriate. Right now it's time, not for tefillah, but it's time for action. It's time for you to just go ahead and do what has to be done. So again, I think it's important to take from that is that you see that Moshe Rabbeinu also doesn't have a particular formula. Sometimes he understands that the situation requires only five words, and sometimes the situation requires a very long tefillah. And unfortunately, we all have situations that are difficult, that are challenging for all of us in our own level. Some people have struggling with shidduchim, and some people are struggling with parnasa, and others are struggling with a refuah. Everybody has their own particular situation that they deal with, but we all offer something that speaks to us. We all offer. God is a Shamea Tefillah. He's willing to listen to any tefillah that is offered, and there is no one formula that is expected or that is necessary for any given predicament that a person finds themselves in. All of them are considered to be acceptable, and all of them are considered to be beloved and very much cherished. So we begin to talk about how exactly one is supposed to offer a tefillah on a chole. And here we come across a Gemara, the number Beis on the shore sheet. The Gemara says in Brachos, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph, Kal Mevakesh Rachamim Al Chaveiro, says the Gemara. Anyone who is in a situation where they're offering a tefillah on behalf of a friend or a loved one, Ein Sar Sheyazgir Lo Shem. You don't have to say, I'm davening on behalf of this person. Why not? Shenamar, because the Pasuk says by Moshe Rabbeinu, when he goes ahead and offers a tefillah on behalf of his sister's illness, he doesn't give any identifying characteristics about her. All he says is, Kelna Refan Allah. He doesn't even say who he's talking about. And yet the Gemara says, Velo Hizkir Shmashal Miriam. He doesn't say, God, please, my sister Miriam is not well. The whole Jewish people is waiting to travel because she's sick. He doesn't say anything. All he says is, I want you to have mercy and grant a refuah. And therefore, says the Gemara, there's no reason to mention the name, because we learn already there's a precedent by Moshe Rabbeinu that the name was not mentioned when he offers a tefillah on behalf of his sister. Now the Magen Avraham quotes this Gemara, and the Magen Avraham on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch has a little bit of an issue, because he mentions that the Zohar HaKadosh writes, when Yaakov Avinu is offering a tefillah, that he should be saved, so he says, Hatzilenina miyad achi miyad Esav. I want that you should save me, God, from my brother, from Esav. Why do you have to say, from my brother, from Esav? You don't have any other brothers. So obviously, when you say, I want you to save me, God, it means, save me from my brother Esav. Why does Yaakov Avinu have to add that extra phrase of, miyad achi, miyad Esav? Says the Zohar HaKadosh, because whenever a person is offering any kind of tefillah, tzarech lefareit b'chol mada efshar, a person has to concentrate the tefillah and specialize it as much as they can toward the intended party that they want that tefillah to work for. So says the Zohar HaKadosh, when Yaakov Avinu is offering a tefillah and he says, Hatzilenina miyad achi miyad Esav, specifically goes out of his way to give yet another identifying characteristic about his brother. He says, I want you to save me from my brother, from Esav. He goes as explicitly as possible, says the Zohar HaKadosh, when a person offers a tefillah, one should say as directly as they can what it is that they're asking for, who it is that they're davening for, and with as much detail as they possibly can. So here, the Magen Avraham is faced with an issue. On the one hand, the Zohar HaKadosh says you have to be mefaret, you have to, what's the English word for that? Mefaret. Specify? There's no better word? You have to be specific, okay. What? You have to give as much detail as you can about the chola, about the person. You have to specify as much as possible. But yet, our Gemara says that when Moshe Rabbeinu offers a tefillah on behalf of his sister, he does not do that. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't even say who he's davening for. He doesn't even say what the cause of his distress is. So says the Magen Avraham, what's the proper way to daven? On the one hand, we have Moshe Rabbeinu who doesn't say anything about who it is or what it is that he wants. And on the other hand, you have the Zohar HaKadosh that says, Yaakov Avinu asks so specifically in such detail, and he says, Miyad Achi Miyad Esav, which one is it? Says the Magen Avraham, the answer is it depends whether you're in the presence of the chole or whether you're davening for them somewhere else. If you're in the hospital room, if you're right near the bedside and you're offering a tefillah, it's clear, it's obvious that the one who you're offering a tefillah for is the person who's right in front of me. So there, that's when our Gemara says, like Moshe Rabbeinu, he was in front of his sister, he went to visit her, he sees how sick she is, he offers a tefillah, there's no reason for him to say who it is that he's davening for. However, when you're not in the presence of the chola, the Gemara says, if you're not in the presence of the chola, we're told one is supposed to identify as much as they can who it is that they're davening for and what it is that they want. So that's what we learn. That's what the Magen Avraham teaches. And I think it's a relevant point. I don't know about everyone else, but I every once in a while get a text where they say this to Tehillim, daven this for that, or I have a friend who's suffering with infertility, I have a friend who's going through this problem or that issue. And again, it's very nice that we should all help them out, but I always write back, can you give me the name of the person, the Hebrew name of the person, who it is that we're davening for and what it is that we want? So sometimes the person will respond, you know, they don't want to give away details of who it is. I understand, again, we don't need to know the person's English name, you don't have to identify who it is, it's not important, but it is relevant to offer a tefillah on behalf of somebody. You should specify as much as you can who it is that you're davening for and what kind of Yeshua you want for that person. So that's something to keep in mind when we get these mass emails or whatever it might be. It is important to know what happened, what's the issue, and what it is, who it is that we're davening for to offer a tefillah on behalf of that person. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in the Halicha Shlomo that sometimes in a shul, after davening, they get up and they say, someone's having surgery today, and let's say a kapitel tehillim before everybody leaves. So he says, although it's a very nice practice, he said the more proper way to do it is, before you make that announcement that we're going to say tehillim, you should say, there's somebody who is having a surgery, we're going to daven on their behalf, and their name is X Ben Y. You're going to say exactly who the name is in order that everybody in their tefillah should be able to zero in on that individual person. You don't have to know who it is in the English language. You don't have to know who it is. You know, if they don't want to give away the details, you don't have to say, I think most people don't know each other by their first and last Hebrew names. I'm not sure everybody does. So therefore, that's an important point to be aware of. The Chasam Sofer even writes, yeah? No, you can start. I don't know. I think that's a great question. How long are you supposed to continue praying for someone? So, you know, it happens to be this week. I was talking to someone in shul who, this is not a breach of confidentiality at all. They told me I can share this. So this person told me that they unfortunately suffered with infertility for a number of years. And at the time, they went to a number of very prominent rabbanim to seek counsel and to accept brachos. So at the time, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was alive at the time, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe told this person that there's a particular tefillah that they should offer. I don't know exactly where this tefillah comes from, but it's a beautiful tefillah. He showed it to me this week. It's a really beautiful tefillah. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe said to him that I want you to take this tefillah to other Rabbanim and ask them what they think about it. Don't just trust me. So he went around to other Rabbanim as well, and he showed it to them, and all the other Rabbanim thought it was a great idea. It was a very beautiful tefillah, very beautifully stated. And this person said the tefillah in the end was blessed with a number of children. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe said the one caveat is even after you do have children, even after you are blessed with the children, you have to continue to daven for all those who unfortunately are going through the same situation that you're going through now. And I think that's an important point. Even if you have people on your cholim list and you say, well, they probably got better already, it's important to daven even for those who might have the problem later on in the future. So either you're going to daven for this person because they're still sick, and if they're not still sick, you're davening for the rest of the world who might have the issue, who might be inflicted with the pain. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my father says it all the time. People come to him and share all of their terrible circumstances that they're going through. They never tell him that it worked out. So again, it's an important thing as a consumer. It's an important thing that if you ever are shown late by anyone, you go to a doctor and you tell them, I need help with this situation, and you don't end up getting back to them to let them know that it worked out, that they gave you a great idea and everything came out to be positive. It's something that the doctor would very much appreciate knowing about. It's something that the person, whoever you ask Eitzah from, would be very happy to know about as well. The Chasam Sofer has a comment where he writes that when Yitzchak Avinu is davening for his wife is in Akara, his wife is not able to have children, so when Yitzchak Avinu is davening, so the first time we encounter Yitzchak davening, it says, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basada. It says he goes outside, for whatever reason he felt that that was a good place to daven, so that's where he goes. How come when he comes to daven for his wife, it says, Vayetar Yitzchak Lenochach Ishto? He's davening in front of his wife. First of all, there's no mechitza, what's going on? They're davening together, but the Chasam Sofer says, why doesn't he go out to the same sada, to the same field that he davened the first time? Why is he coming up with a new place to daven in the middle of his living room with his wife? So the Chasam Sofer explains, no, there's a good reason for it. Chasam Sofer suggests, because the Magen Avraham that we just mentioned states that when a person davens in front of he or she who is ill, he or she who has the problem, you don't have to mention the name. It's clear, it's obvious that you're offering the tefillah on behalf of that individual, on behalf of that person. However, if you're davening not in the presence of that person, you do have to mention their name. Here, Yitzchak Avinu is faced with a problem. On the one hand, he has a lot of kavanah when he davens outside, and that's why he went the first time. Lasuach basada, that's the right place to daven. And really, we know a person should be koveya makam letfilaso. A person should be finding a place and sticking in that place. Daven each and every time the tefillah in the same place. That's something we'll talk about maybe in future weeks. That there is this idea that we learn from Avram Avinu that a person should offer a tefillah in the same place. It means even if you daven at home, even if one davens at home, you should find a particular place in your home which you find to be helpful for your kavanah and stick to that place. It shouldn't be every day haphazardly somewhere else. A person should be koveya makom letfilaso. So Yitzchak Avinu really should have done the same thing, but yet Yitzchak Avinu said, I don't want to daven somewhere which is not in the presence of my wife, because then I have to say Rivka Bas, who is her father? Besuel. I don't want to have to say Rivka, the daughter of this Russia, this terrible... I don't want to remind God of her terrible past. And therefore, I don't want to have to say her name. So Yitzchak specifically goes to daven in the presence of his wife. Vayeter Yitzchak lenochach ishto. This way, says the Chasam Sofer, he didn't have to mention the name of her father who was such a Russia. He doesn't want to remind God about that. He only wants to focus in on his wife. And that's why he davened specifically in the presence of his wife. So this is a very important halacha to be aware of. And I think it's important, let's say, for another very prevalent example. It comes up every so often that you have a situation where a child is born prematurely, or a child is born with a severe illness, unfortunately, and the child is going to be in the hospital for a long, extended period of time sometimes. And the question often arises, well, we know that the practice is when it's a baby boy, we usually wait to give the name by the bris. But this child is not going to have a bris for another 7, 8, 9 months. So that's a major question. What do you do in a case like that? So this is something that was asked, and it's mentioned in the Nishmas Avram. The Nishmas Avram, if you don't have the Sefer at home, it's written in Hebrew and in English. It's an amazing compilation of medical issues. The Nishmas Avram was written by Dr. Abraham. Dr. Abraham Abraham. That's his first and last name, Avram Avram. And he is a really tremendous Talmud Chacham and a tremendous resource. He's an amazing personality. I think it's Nishmas Avram is 6 volumes in Hebrew, but I think in English they shortened it a little bit. A beautiful set of svarim. In English, it's called Nishmat Avraham. In Hebrew, it's called Nishmas Avraham, surprisingly. So it's a really beautiful set of svarim. If this kind of, if medical halacha is of interest to you, you should really get one of those sets. So the Nishmas Avraham discusses that he spoke with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach about this issue. Should you give a name before the child gets out of the hospital, or should you say, no, we're going to wait for the bris, because if the bris is going to be at 8 months, that's when we're going to give the name. And until then, we're not going to have a name. So he said that there are 3 reasons why he feels that a name should be given in advance, even before the child gets out of the hospital. 3 reasons. Number one, he says, because psychologically for the parents, it's very helpful for them to know, this child has hope. We're going to give the child a name now because we hope that the child will one day use that name. If you don't give a name, it means you're going to call the child Baby X or Baby Y, whatever it might be. It's not like you're considering the child to be a Bar Kayama. You don't believe that the kid is going to get out. So number one, he says he found that psychologically. Again, some places it might be the case, some places it might not be. But he said he found psychologically that it helps parents who are going through that kind of situation to have that foresight that, yes, we're going to give a name now because this is the name he's going to live by his whole life, and one day he's going to become better and he's going to get out of this. He felt that was one reason to give. Number two, he said, it helps, he found in his experience, he is a doctor, Dr. Abraham. So he said in his experience, he has found that the doctors and the nurses in the hospital give better care to a child who has a name than a child who doesn't have a name. Because they themselves see that the family cares enough about this child to give them a name and to really believe that something is going to come of the kid. Very similar to the first psychological insight, but he says he's found that when a kid just goes for months and months without a name, it's very unusual that that happens because usually we give an English name, right, on the birth certificate instead of waiting for later on, so you give an English name. But he says that he's found that giving a name does help for the doctors and the nurses, the medical staff, to take the child's care very seriously, more so than if a name wasn't given. But number three, and most importantly, he says, for all those months that the child is going to be in the hospital, it's better that the kid should have a name because people are going to daven on behalf of the child. And he says, we find here in the Magen Avraham that one is supposed to be mefarit as much as possible. One is supposed to say with as much descriptive detail as they can everything that is able to be expressed about he or she that they're davening for. Therefore, says the Nishmas Avraham in the name of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it makes sense to give a name earlier in order that all those who are going to daven on behalf of the chola, on this young child, should daven with more descriptive detail. This is what my father tells parents as well. Again, there are some parents who feel more comfortable. We want to have a bris like everybody else. We want to have a naming like everybody else. That's okay as well. But if you're dealing with a situation where they don't mind either way, my father suggests all the time that he thinks it makes a lot of sense to give the name in advance, even though the bris is not going to be for a long while, because we assume that this would help people be able to be mispalel, to daven on behalf of the young and sick child. So that's a very important outgrowth of this discussion that we're having from the Magen Avraham, that one is supposed to be mefaritas hatfila as much as they can. So what if you have a situation where you don't know the person's name? So it's told about the Chazon Ish, that when the Chazon Ish was davening on behalf of Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky was one of the great contemporaries, one of the great Gedolim, and the problem was he didn't know his Hebrew name. He didn't know exactly how to daven for him. He just heard that Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky was sick. So he offered a tefillah and he said, God should offer refuah shlema to the person who wrote the Chazon Yecheskel. He gave an identifying characteristic that way. He said, look, I don't know his name, but God knows there's only one person who wrote this set of svarim called Chazon Yecheskel, and that's good enough. So again, this is something that one should think about, that you should try to give as much detail as you possibly can about the chola, he or she that you are davening for. Again, if you don't know how to get more details, so you say whatever you can. But if you are able to get details, that is something that is better. And that includes even if they do a shinui hashem, if they change the name of the chola. Very often you have a situation where somebody's sick and they change the name. So in a case like that also, you're supposed to start to daven for the change name, not for the old name, because we assume the person now takes on a new existence. My father always points out that when we have a name changing, whatever you call that, ceremony, I guess, my father always thinks that it's done inappropriately. He says sometimes they'll change the name when the person is literally on their deathbed the day before they pass away. He says that doesn't make any sense. You don't change a name then. The whole idea of changing a name is to switch someone's mazel. You switch a mazel when it's reasonable that the person can actually recover. You don't switch a name when somebody is, you know, really has basically no hope left for a recovery. So that's what my father always points out. He thinks that it's a little bit inappropriate that we do a Shinei Hashem so late on in the prognosis. We should do a Shinei Hashem when a person is in a serious condition but has the ability to have a recovery. That's what my father has suggested on many occasions. Yeah. Questions?
When my dad was in the hospital for 6 months, they felt uncomfortable giving him a name.
Right.
And the rabbi did say to put, as you said, as much detail as possible. So it's Tinoch ben Aviva Bat Chana. They said to him, just mention the mother's name.
Very interesting. So I guess that's why. That's very interesting. So again, so here you have a situation where parents chose not to give a name. They wanted to have a bris like everybody else. But at the same time, the Rabbanim advised them that you should give more descriptive details. So say the child, Tinok, Ben, the mother, and the grandmother. That's a very insightful comment. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. His mother, her mother was probably also a... Right, so that's a question in general. Why, that leads into the next point, why do we mention the name of the mother specifically and not the father? Generally, when we daven for a chola, we mention only the mother's name and not the father's name. Where does that come from? So, that's a very important question. And certainly it's an important question because if you've ever noticed, when we call someone up to a Torah, when we do anything else, when we do a Azkara for a Kel Mele, we always say the father's name. So what happened over here that we suddenly begin to mention the mother's name when it comes to davening on behalf of a chola? So this really finds itself in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos. The Gemara says in number Gimel here that there is a precedent for this. The Gemara says that Amar Li Aim, one of the Amoraim says, my mother told me, surprisingly, his mother told him, Kol inyana bishma de'imi. Anytime you're davening on behalf of a chola, you should use the name of mother. Now, of course his mother said that. It's his mother. But there's a reason for this. So the Gemara says that this is the rule, that you're always supposed to say the name of the mother instead of the name of the father. But the Gemara doesn't really explain why that is the case. So the Zohar HaKadosh actually points out that this is the reason why we say in Tehillim, David HaMelech says, Ani Avdecha Ben Amasecha, I am your Eved, the son of my mother. Why doesn't he say, I'm your Eved, the son of my father? So he says, because he's following this Gemara, when he's offering a tefillah on his behalf that he should be saved, he says, Ani Avdecha, I am your servant, the son of my mother instead of the son of my father. And that's the question, why is that the case? So some Achronim say, well, the rationale for that is, the reason why we mention specifically the name of the mother and not the father is because men are obligated in many more mitzvahs than women are. Men are obligated in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And men have an obligation that every free moment of the day, that they're not doing something else, they have to learn Torah. Now, which men are able to say with a clear conscience that they really follow to that rule, and every free second of the day that they have, they're busy learning Torah and not doing other things? I don't know. Most men that I know have a serious problem answering that question very well. And therefore, says the Ben Ish Chai and other Achronim, we don't want to mention the terrible fathers who violate Averas, who waste time all day, who are violating all the Averas of Bittul Torah and everything else that they're expected to do. Therefore, we mention the mothers, because the mothers are much greater tzidkanias than the men are, and therefore we really want to remind God of the wonderful mothers, we don't want to remind them of the horrible fathers. That's what some Achronim say. I don't know, maybe that's a suggestion, I'm not sure if we accept it or not, it sounds very strange to me. But there is a different suggestion which I found to be much more important, and that is that many Achronim write, the reason why we mention the mother's name is because, like the Magen Avraham mentioned, if we know that you're supposed to specify, if you're supposed to give as much detail as you can about the chola, the father is never an absolute. We never know for sure that this is the father. You always know with certainty that this is the mother. So if you're supposed to say as much detail as you can about the person you're davening for, the greatest detail you can give is, this is his mother. To say this is the father, well, you're never really sure. So nowadays you'll say, we have DNA testing and we know who everybody is. That just opens up a whole interesting discussion, because DNA testing, unfortunately, when the Twin Towers were destroyed, so there were a number of Shilohs of Aguna. There were a number of women whose husbands were said to be in the Twin Towers. They worked there every day, and they hadn't really heard with certainty that their husbands were killed. So this was a major question. If some sort of sampling of a body was found afterward when they were going through the rubble, and they were able to test it and determine that this was part of the husband's body in some way, so can we determine that this woman is allowed to get remarried and she's no longer an aguna, which opened up a major Pandora's box. We assume that DNA is accepted al pi halacha or not, because how are you going to know with certainty this is the husband? Only with a DNA test. Well, who said DNA is recognized? So there were some Rabbanim and Bnei Brak who wrote, we don't recognize DNA because science is treif and we don't recognize any of that. Okay, so some believe that. Some live life that way. I think most in our community probably do not accept it. It's a way of life. I don't think it's the way that most of us live life. I think most of us probably do believe in science. Well, if we believe in science, the outgrowth of that should be that we believe in DNA testing. And that should mean that we're allowed to be matur in aguna. Now, some of the contemporaries had an issue with that, because once you're going to recognize DNA and halacha and say that now we can determine that this is really the husband's body, and now the wife is allowed to get remarried, which is a wonderful thing. We can be matur to go and get remarried. However, the problem is going to be, it's going to work against us. When is it going to work against us? If you're going to go start testing everybody, you're going to find out there are a lot of mamzerim in the world. There are a lot of people in the world who had children that were really not from their own husbands, and people who they should not have had children from. So if you're going to start recognizing DNA to allow an aguna to get remarried, then you're going to go ahead and start using DNA to call out a lot of mamzerim and say you're not allowed to marry a Jewish person. So this was a major issue, and some said, therefore, we're not going to be able to recognize DNA because it's going to come back to bite us. So my father and his school of thought felt, that's also inappropriate. What do you mean? If you believe in the authenticity of science, and you believe that this is something that we really should be accepting, then you accept it across the board, even though it's going to come to bite you later on. Right now, this DNA, meaning we don't have an obligation to go around and start pricking everyone and testing them and taking samplings to figure out whether or not they're mamzerim. If it comes out later on by somebody taking a test that they are mamzer, so be it. So that's what happens. Unfortunately, that's what happens. But we do believe in science, and if we believe in science, then it means we believe in DNA. If we believe in DNA, it means we believe in it both Lakula and Lachumra. It means we're going to allow an Aguna to get remarried, and we're going to, unfortunately, sometimes discover that somebody might be a mamzer who's not allowed to get married. So this is an issue in general with DNA testing, but again, although we assume that DNA testing is acceptable, it's much easier to know that somebody's mother is their mother. There's no denying who a mother is. That's clear, that's always documented, that we know with certainty who the mother really is. And therefore, we assume that when davening on behalf of a cholem, either a man or a woman, we always mention the name of the mother in order that it should be as descriptive as possible. And as you mentioned, a very beautiful comment that sometimes when you don't have descriptive detail, you should say the name of the grandmother. Very interesting comment, because I think, again, that points to what the Magen Avraham says in the name of the Zohar, that a person, Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad Esav, you should say as best as you can the most descriptive detail that you possibly can share. Yeah. What happens with an adopted person? That's a good question. In terms of? Whose name did you say? And the adopted person is a non-Jew? The adopted person was converted? So their mother is a non-Jew? Meaning generally when we do adoptions... Right. So the Stipler talks about what do you do with an adopted child. It's in the Sefer Archas Rabbeinu. And in the Stipler, he says that he thinks you should adopt the name of the mother who adopted the child. Because for all intents and purposes, that's the mother. Again, the story of adoption is a very beautiful sugya to talk about. It's a very interesting issue, and it comes up in many different ways. Just recently, there was a very prominent person whose mother passed away. I had no idea, but this was his mother for the last 55 years, and it wasn't really his mother. His mother passed away when he was 3 years old or something like that. And this was, his father got remarried when he was a young child, and they lived a very beautiful life together. And the question was, when his mother passed away, does he really sit shiva? Does he really do all these things? Does he rip his clothing? Does he take off his shoes? Is he supposed to do everything that a novel does? Does he say Kaddish? And again, this is a very important issue, because for all intents and purposes, it was his mother, and she did adopt him. But at the same time, it's not his mother. So it's a very difficult issue to figure out. Where do you draw the line with that? I have a sefer at home, which is a sefer all about all the issues of adoption and what you can possibly talk about. Again, the most prominent and prevalent issue is yichud. What do you do about the fact that sometimes you adopt, let's say, a boy, and your husband is out working, and you're going to be at home with this person all the time? So on the one hand, there's no yichud between a mother and a child. On the other hand, this is not your child. This is only someone you adopted into your home. So this is a very, very interesting and important question to deal with as a child might get older, to figure out how do you deal with yichud issues and how do you deal with other things. It's not really what we're discussing today, but as far as the tefillah goes, the Stipler writes in the Sefer Archas Rabbeinu that he thinks you should say the name of the adopted mother, because for all intents and purposes, that is considered his mother. Yeah. Yes. Or when you talk about PGDs and when you talk about all the different issues that we deal with today, so you have three mothers sometimes. Makes things very complicated. Sometimes you have an implant that's done from one woman that's put into another. There's one carrier, one donor, and then there's someone else who also was involved somewhere along the way. Sometimes you can have three mothers. So it's becoming more and more complicated. But this is a major question, a major issue, but not really in the scope of today's discussion. When we generally daven for a chola, you'll look in your siddur, it says, we always say, l'ramach evarav u'shesa gidav. They should be offered a refuah to the ramach evarav, to the 248 limbs, and to the shasa gidim. Shasa is 365. I don't know what that means. Sinews or arteries, veins. I'm not sure exactly how to translate that in English, but that's what we generally say. Why do we assume that there are 248 limbs and 365 arteries? So that's based on the Gemara. The Gemara says that was the assumption. And that was always what they believed to be the case. However, the Gemara says, Pam achas, there was once a time where they did a dissection. And they took a cadaver and they tried to take it apart to figure out, are we really correct in our assumption? So the Gemara says, how do they do a dissection? You're not just allowed to do that for no reason. You have to be cover the body. You're not just allowed to dissect the body for no reason. So the Gemara says, no, there was a story about a shifcha achas, about a woman, a non-Jewish woman who was killed by the local authorities for doing something wrong, whatever it was, and they just left her body on the side of the road. So the Talmidim in the yeshiva thought this was a great opportunity to really dissect the body and figure out, we're going to bury her after we're done, but maybe this is a great opportunity for us to find out, are we really correct in our assumption that there are 248 limbs and there are 365 arteries? So this was what they did, and lo and behold, they came out that a woman has a few more body parts than a man has. So this is very surprising to them. And the Gemara says that they came to the conclusion that a woman has resh nun beze varm. A woman has 352 body parts and not like a man who has 200... Sorry, no, what did I just say? Resh nun beze is 252 instead of 248. That was the That was what they came up with. So the Minchas Elazar, the Munkach Rebbe, has a very amusing tshuva where somebody wrote to him that when we say Kriya Shema on our own, when we say Kriya Shema b'yechidus, privately, so we generally add on the words Kel Melech Ne'eman. Right? I think most people have that practice. Where does that come from? Kel Melech Ne'eman, why do we say that? Because we want to get Kriya Shema to the number of 248 words. And you're missing three, so therefore we add on three words. When you're davening in the context of a tzibur, when you're davening together, so the Chazan says, Hashem Elokechem Emes, so that ends the three words. But when you're davening at home, so you say, Kel Melech Ne'eman, because that's the way to make up for the three words that are missing. That's the assumption. So this person wrote to the Minchas Elazar, maybe a woman who shouldn't make it to 248 because she has 252, the Gemara says, so maybe we assume that a woman should say something different or should say it twice or whatever it might be. I don't know, I found that a very amusing comment. But anyway, this is a comment that is made also. Let's say someone has an amputation. So what are you going to say? You're going to start offering a different tefillah now because now they have different amount of body parts? I'm not sure. But Rav Moshe writes in a tshuva that when davening on behalf of a woman, because we assume that the number of organs, of limbs, is different in the woman than it is in the man, therefore Rav Moshe writes that more proper, more correct in the tefillah is to say when you're davening on behalf of a woman, you should say l'chol evareh u'l'chol gidel. You should say Hashem should offer refuah for all of her parts and for all of her valves, for all of her arteries. Why is that? Because he says, if you're going to say l'ramachei v'areah for a 248, what about the other four? They should die. The other four body parts should stop working. So therefore, Moshe says, and you look in your sitter. If you look in the sitter, you'll notice when it says a mishaberach for a man, it says the man should have a refuah for his 248 and 365. When you talk about a tefillah for a woman, it says l'chol evareh u'l'chol gideh. The reason for that difference is because we assume that a woman has a different number of organs than a man does, and therefore we assume the tefillah has to be changed a little bit. Very interesting, but something I'm not sure that everybody noticed on their own. There is a story told about an encounter that took place between the Satmar Rebbe and Rav Moshe Feinstein. So the Satmar Rebbe was a contemporary of his, so they once met each other, and Rav Moshe turned to him and he said, "Nu, you're a Rebbe, tell me, people come to you all the time and they ask you for a bracha, they should have a refuah. And you tell them, you should have a refuah shlema. What does it mean, refuah shlema? You should have a complete refuah. What else were you asking for? If you say somebody should have a refuah, did you mean, what? Half of it? So what did it mean? So why do you have to say refuah shlema? I want you to have a complete refuah. Obviously, it's what you mean. You should have a refuah. That's what it means. So what does it mean when you give them a bracha, you should have a refuah shlema? And we say it all the time. You should have a refuah shlema. What does it mean? So the Satmar Rebbe was very sharp, so he turned back to Rav Moshe. He says, "Well, you're putting me on the spot, I'll put you on the spot. When people come to you and they say, well, I'm having an issue, I did this there, what should I do? He says, you should have a bracha, you should do a tshuva shlema. What does it mean, a tshuva shlema? What do you think? Otherwise, you should do a half a tshuva? So what do you mean when you say you should do a tshuva shlema? It's the same thing I mean when I say refuah shlema." So the Satmar Rebbe explained what it means is as follows. By tshuva, the Rambam writes, what is a meaningful tshuva? What does it mean for a person to go through an experience of tshuva that is something that is going to be lasting? Something that the week after Yom Kippur, I'm not just going to go back to the way I was. Says the Rambam, a tshuva is when a person gets to the point, Sheyayid alav yodea talumas, that God can say with confidence about you, Shelo yashiv bazeh hachet liolam, that you're never going to go back to those old ways. Now you're a different person. Like the Rambam says, Ani ish acher, I'm somebody else. I'm not the same old person that I used to be a week ago before Yom Kippur. And this is not a joke. The Rambam says that's what a real meaningful tshuva process is, when a person is able to bring themselves to a point when God can say with certainty, you have changed yourself to the point that I know you're never going to go back to those ways. That's not something that you are, it's not something you relate to, it's not something you identify with. Now you're a totally different person, you have recreated yourself. That's what a real meaningful tshuva process is. Said Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's what we mean when we say someone should have a tshuva shlema experience. Not just that you should do tshuva and then go back to the way you were. You should have a complete tshuva which is irreversible. You're not going back to that old way. It's a tshuva shlema, an absolute tshuva that you'll never go back. Said the Satmar Rebbe, that's what it means here as well. We offer some refuah, we say, you shouldn't just have a temporary fix. You shouldn't just get out of this illness. You should have a fix, a refuah that's going to be shlema, that you're never going to go back to it, that it's something you're never going to have to deal with again. That's the bracha that we offer people, that they should have a refuah shlema l'chol evareim l'chol gideim. They shouldn't have to worry about the issue that they were worrying about before. This should be not just a temporary fix, but something that is going to be everlasting. And if you take that line of thinking one step further, what is the last thing that we say shlema? We say a person should have a refuah shlema, a tshuva shlema, and what? Nope. Geula shlema. Why do we say geula shlema? It's the same reason. Because we offer and we want that we should have a geula, we should be redeemed, not just a temporary redemption. We want that it should be once and for all. We should be zocha to have the geula shleima. We shouldn't have to deal with any of our adversaries anymore. We shouldn't have to deal with anyone who is opposing all that we stand for and who is standing up not to allow us to do what we want to do. That is what a geula shleima means, the same way it's what a refuah shleima means, and the same way it's what a tshuva shleima means, which is an important comment to think about as we daven. Exactly. That's what someone pointed out last night. You should say all of that with an emunah shleima, that you're never going to go back and question God's decisions. Absolutely correct. I think it's a great point. So what about when a person is davening for a parent? What about when a person is davening for a parent or for a very well-respected personality in the community? So what's the difference? Why should you say anything should be different then? So the reason why is as follows. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Tzadites. The Gemara wants to know, how do you categorize an apikoros? So if I would ask anyone in the room, who do you think is an apikoros? Not a person, but what category of people do you think is an apikoros? So you'll say somebody who feels the Torah is not authentic, or somebody who outright feels we're not following the Din of Derabbanan. I'm not interested in the mitzvah of lulav, I'm not doing shofar, this is not for me, Shabbos is not for me. It's somebody who picks and chooses, that's an apikoros. Somebody who doesn't believe in the complete authenticity of Torah is somebody who's an apikoros. But the Gemara says, yeah, that's the easy definition. The more subtle definition of an apikoros is somebody who, the Gemara says, I forgot to put it on here, someone who is mevaza talmidei chachamim. That's number one, which is... mevaza talmidei chachamim means somebody mevazeh, somebody who shames, who treats very disrespectfully. And I think quite often about all those who attack my father in the newspaper for no good reason. I think about them quite often. You know, what... I don't know. You know, the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos, it's a very personal issue for me, but the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that we daven yitamu chataim velo chotim. We ask that God should not eradicate the world of those who do sin, but God should eradicate the world of those evils themselves. Not of the person. We want that the person should live, but we want that the person should live a life of no longer doing evil. And I think quite often about those people, and we offer a tefillah on their behalf that yitamu chataim velo chotim. We want not that they should perish, but we want that their bad ways should stop being the way they are. But they have a lot to answer for when they very publicly destroy the reputations of Talmidei Chachamim for no good reason and take things out of context. That's what the Gemara says is an apikoros. That's what we assume to be someone who is totally out of the fold. Then the Gemara says, a second definition is someone who is korei l'rabba b'shmo. Somebody who calls their Rebbe or someone who they very much respect by their first name. That's what the Gemara says is also someone who's defined as an apikoros. And then the Gemara goes on to give a description about how it knows this and a source for this. But that's basically the understanding that the Gemara has, which I always point out whenever I speak to boys in YU. This applies not only to a Rebbe, it applies not only to a rabbi, but it applies also to parents. It applies to parents. There are a lot of people in my generation whose parents want to feel young and whose parents want to be part of the chevra, so the parents ask their children to call them by their first names. I have a friend who calls his mother by her first name. And to me, besides for being highly disrespectful, it's absolutely us. So the Shulchan Aruch says even if a parent asks that a child do that because it feels good for them to be young, to be one of the chevra, to be like everybody else, Shulchan Aruch says clearly a child has no right to listen to a parent when they have such a request. You're not allowed to call a parent by a first name because a child has an obligation of kavod and of mora, of respecting their parent and of fearing their parent. That is not so respectful or holding your parent in a high regard if you call them by the first name. So this is something the Shulchan Aruch writes, and it's something that we need to be very, very careful about, not only in terms of rabbeim and people who we respect, but also in terms of parents as well. I don't know if people deal with these kinds of issues, but a lot of people in my generation, I know, are calling their parents by the first name, and it's highly inappropriate. It's something that is absolutely usur. So the question is, when a person is davening on behalf of a parent, how exactly do I mention my parent? Whenever I'm talking about my parent, I shouldn't call them by the first name. So again, the Acharonim write, whenever it's necessary, whenever I'm filling out a medical form, so I have to write my parent's name. Just the other week, we had a call with a doctor. My siblings had a call with a doctor to discuss something about my father's medical history. So nothing wrong, but we were just discussing it. So the doctor on the phone, it started getting very complicated. He was talking about Rabbi Schechter, which is my father, and then he was trying to address me, so he called me Rabbi Schechter, and then he said, it was just getting very complicated. So he was saying, well, Rabbi Schechter Jr., Rabbi Schechter Sr., Rabbi Schechter Middle, my brother was on the phone also. So it was getting very complicated. So I said, look, the Shulchan Aruch says, just call everybody by the first name. My father in this conversation is Herschel. We're trying to talk about his medical condition. My name is Shai. My brother's name is Yo. Let's just talk openly. Let's just not get complicated here. And that's exactly what the Achronim say. If there is a reason to do it, if it's very important, and that's going to keep things simple, so that's what you do because that's what you have to do. However, otherwise we assume a parent has to be referred to as Avi Mori or Imi Morasi. You're supposed to refer to them with a title of respect to show that you very much value their position that they have attained in life and their position over you. So what about when a person is offering a tefillah on behalf of someone who is sick? So how do you offer a tefillah on behalf of a parent when a parent is sick? So do you say that God should offer refuah shleima to Avi Mori, this and this and that, you say the name? So the Minchas Chinuch and others, Rabbi Kiva Eger, write that no. We have a concept, we have a principle that ein gavhus lefnei hamakom. It's inappropriate to say, when you're addressing God, you say, oh, my father is the God of Ador. That's inappropriate. God, again, in God's eyes, either all of us are nothing or all of us are something. God doesn't care about all the titles that we human beings give each other or all the status that we consider one person to be above someone else. So when you're addressing God and when you're talking to him about a particular person, you don't say any titles. You just say Ploni ben Plonis. You just say the person's name without Harav, without a this, without a that, without a Shlita, without a Zatzal, nothing. You just say the person's name as it is. And this is why my father expressed to me that he remembered when Rabbi Yashiv was not well and he was at the end of his life. So they hung up signs all over the place and they sent out messages that everyone should daven for Marenu Harav, Yosef Shalom Ben, whoever it was, whatever his mother's name was. And my father thought that that's not a way to daven. You don't say we should daven for Moreno Harab. You say we should daven for Yosef Shalom Ben. Because when it comes to a tefillah, we don't have any additional titles. All the status falls aside. Ein gavus lefnei hamakom, we assume that everybody is equal and significant in the eyes of God. And therefore, nobody's title should be added when you're addressing either a tefillah on behalf of a Talmud Chacham or a tefillah on behalf of a parent. When you're saying the parent should have a refuah shleima, you just say the parent's name as it is. You don't say Avi Mori. That's what my father, I remember, by my grandfather's levaya, although my grandfather was a very prominent person, and he was a very highly respected person. When he came to say the Kelmali, my father said, you don't say Harav in the Kelmali, you don't say Morenu in the Kelmali, you just say my grandfather's name, as it was, you don't add anything, else to that. Let's just close with... So if you're a Gabbai and you're calling your father up for an aliyah, you do say. And the reason for that is because there's a major difference between being a Gabbai and between offering a tefillah. When you're being a Gabbai, you're not addressing the Ribbono Shel Olam, you're addressing the community. You're saying, Ya'amod, I'm singling out from everybody in this room, this person. So over there, when we human beings are talking to each other, we do talk with respect. We do add superlatives. We do add titles. When you're addressing God himself in a tefillah, so that's when we say, leave it aside. I remember I asked my father once, so why is it that we say in the Harachaman, so Rachamanu Yivarech Es Avi Mori, Ves Imi Morasi, that's what we say in the Harachaman. That doesn't seem to fit this rule. So my father said it's a good question. He never saw anyone who asked that. I did later find that Rabbi Avadia Yosef's son points it out as well. I guess this is, the fathers don't think of it. The sons pointed out to their great fathers. So Rabbi Avadia Yosef's son writes that he pointed it out to his father as well. He was wondering why that's the exception to the rule, and his father said, yeah, there are some communities where they don't say that, where they just say, Harachamani Varachas Avi, but I've never seen any sitter or any bencher or any machzer that leaves that out, so I don't know how to answer that exactly, but generally when we offer a tefillah, we are not supposed to say any additional titles, you just say the person's name as it is. Also, so my father told me that when you say Yisker, a person should just say the parent's name, or you say Avi or Imi, because when you're offering a tefillah, you don't say anything. So now, here's a general question. Let's say when you're writing a ksuba or a get, so do you write, let's say when I got married, so they wrote, my name is Aaron Yeshaya, so do I write, my name is Aaron Yeshaya ben Harav Tzvi, or do I write ben Tzvi? How do I refer to my father? Or when I sign a ksuba sometimes at a wedding, what do I write? Do I write Aaron Yeshaya ben Harav Tzvi, or do I leave all the titles out? So there we assume by Iksuba generally, and my Iksuba, which my father wrote, it says Ben Harav Tzvi. That's what it says. But in a get, the Ramah says you're not supposed to have any titles. In a get, you're not supposed to because it goes as follows. It's just an interesting point to think about. By Iksuba, who's writing the Iksuba? Who's writing the Iksuba? You're right.
A lawyer.
It's a lawyer. It's the two witnesses on the bottom who are signed are saying, we hereby declare that we watched this and this happen, and this is what the husband obligated himself to do. So when two outside parties are writing about me, they should talk about me with respect, or about my father with respect. By a get, it's the husband instructing his wife, this is what I'm saying. So what, the husband's going to write, my name is Harav Hagon, this and that, and my father is this and that. That's inappropriate to speak about yourself in that way, and that's why in a get, generally we assume you leave out all the titles, because the get is written by the person themselves. The ksuba is written by an outside party. I remember the administrator of the RCA Bezin told me that a couple of years ago he had a woman who came in. She was a female conservative rabbi, came in and asked that the RCA write the get for her. She was getting divorced from her husband. So I don't know if the husband was writing to the wife or the wife was writing to the husband. But anyway, she asked that the RCA Bezin do the get kahalacha. She wanted a proper get. So they were working on it and they were reading the whole thing for her and explaining everything what it says. And then she saw that they didn't write Harav in front of her name, and she was very upset. I'm a female conservative rabbi, why don't you write Harav? So they told her, we're not leaving it out because we don't respect your position as being a female conservative rabbi, we're leaving it out because we don't write it for an Orthodox rabbi either. We don't write Harav in a get for anybody because it's you referring to yourself. And when you're the one who's writing the document, you don't refer to yourself with all the titles. That's basically the issue. One final point that was mentioned last night at the shir that women thought was important to emphasize is, oh, it's almost 10:30, so we'll end in 3 or 4 minutes, if that's okay. I think it's something that people often ask about. The Gemara says that when one's wife is pregnant, is expecting a child, one is not supposed to daven for a boy or a girl once the pregnancy is already in motion. So let's say my wife is 6 months pregnant. We don't assume that I should go ahead, oh, my whole life I wanted a boy, or my whole life I wanted a girl, my whole life I wanted twins or triplets or quadruplets, whatever. You don't start davening now because whatever it is already. So now you're going to start davening that it should be switched to something else. We're not allowed to be mispalel al hanes. The Gemara says you're not allowed to ask for a miracle, and since it's already been determined what gender the child should be and how it should come out, so therefore we assume you're not supposed to daven in that period for a miracle. So that's the general principle. I was asked a very unfortunate shiloh a couple of months ago by a couple who mid-pregnancy found out that they were both, that they were carrying a Tay-Sachs baby. Which is very unusual. We very unusually hear about Tay-Sachs babies nowadays, but that was the case, unfortunately. And they asked me, what tefillah should they offer? Now they found out halfway through the pregnancy that the child is a Tay-Sachs baby. What should they daven for? It's a very unfortunate shaila. So I asked my father what he thought, and my father told me that he thought that the parents should daven that they should be blessed with healthy children. And God can interpret that however he wants. If he interprets it that this child will come out being healthy, so then that's God's doing. I didn't ask for the miracle. If the interpretation of that is the child should ultimately not be born at all and should somehow the pregnancy should be terminated, so that's God's wish as well. Whatever it might be, God wants whatever God wants to answer to my tefillah, my father thought that's the proper way to daven. And again, one always has to keep in mind that we are not allowed to daven for a miracle. And the question is, when it comes to somebody who's at the very late stages of life and unfortunately is suffering tremendously and is having a very difficult time and by all natural means probably will not survive the illness that they have, what are we daven for then? What are we daven for then? What? Refuah Shleima. So to ask for Refuah Shleima, very many assume that that's an inappropriate tefillah. To ask when a person should have a Refuah Shleima at a chance, at a time when the doctors say there's no reasonable assumption that they're going to have a Refuah, is ostensibly davening for a miracle. So this is what the Ran in Maseches Nedarim discusses. And the Ran in Nedarim writes, which might be of surprise, but the Ran writes, at that point you should daven that the person should die peacefully. That's what the Ran writes. Now, this is a very controversial Ran because it makes people very uncomfortable. What do you mean, I'm going to daven that the person should die? So I remember when I was in Eretz Yisrael, my grandfather was very sick in the very last days of his life. So I got a minion together to go to the old city and daven for my grandfather. So we're on our way. My father happened to call me on the way. And he says, oh, it sounds like you're walking somewhere. I said, yes. He says, where are you going? I said, we're going to the old city to daven for your father. So he says to me, what are you davening for exactly? I said, I don't know. What should I be davening for? He said, you're davening that he should get better. He's like, he has whatever cancer he had, and he's 96 years old. He lived a wonderful life, and he's suffering tremendously. Now, what are you davening for? What do you want? You're not allowed to ask for a miracle. So I said, so what do you want me to say? So he says, you should daven that he should die peacefully. So I turned to my friends. I said, hey, we're going to change the venue. We were coming here to daven that my grandfather should have a complete refuah. Now we're going to change the venue of our tefillah. We're now going to daven and offer a tefillah that my grandfather should pass away very peacefully. which was a very uncomfortable thing to daven for, but again, that's what the Ran writes. So again, there are many achronim who find this to be an uncomfortable kind of assumption. How can you daven that somebody should die? How can you say that? So some achronim say what you should daven for is that God should have rachmanis on them. Whatever the tefillah is, God should have rachmanis on them. If it means that they should pass away peacefully, quietly in the near future, so he's having rachmanis on them. Again, I think people often mistakenly feel that life, that every moment of life is, trying to say it very carefully, I'll read the Stipler's words. The Stipler who lived in Bnei Brak wrote the following. He said, "Be'ikra ha'yisod de'kol ma'ashe efshel ha'arech chaye ha'chole." This that people say, this is the Stipler's words, it's not mine. This that people say that kol ma'ashe efshel la'harech chaye ha'chole, as much as you can possibly extend the sick person's life. Afilu eino el l'chayisha, even if it means just for another few hours, a few minutes. Tzrichim la'asos, he says, we have the assumption that this is something that we absolutely must do. Another moment of life is always the answer, is always what we're looking for. He says, MS, the truth is, shagamani shamati bialdusi memra kazu. When I was a young child, I heard this as well. He said, this is what I was taught. Velo yadati imzeo mi bar samchahu. I have no idea if this is from a credible source. I don't really believe that that's true. And the Stipler and others write as well, that again, if the person is suffering terribly, we don't always assume that every moment of life is the greatest gift to them, if they're suffering tremendously. Again, the more Yisurim they have, the more Schar they're going to get in Shamayim, whatever it might be. But you have to take the whole condition into consideration. You have to know the person. You have to ask a Shaila of somebody who understands your family and dynamics very well. And that's why these questions are very, very sensitive. Let me just close with a story from the son of Rabbi Avadi Yosef, who wrote a story about his father, which I think is very much along the lines of what we were saying. He says, Achruni. This was written 12 years ago. So he says, Achruni, I remember Lefnei Karv L'Shloshim Shana. He says, I remember 30 years ago, which means this was around 50 years ago or 45 years ago. She'echad ha'gvirim ha'nechbadim in Geneva. There was a very wealthy individual in Geneva who owned a bank. Pana lamaran adoni avi mori v'rabi shlita. He turned to my father, Rabbi Avadi Yosef. He asked my father that he has a client in his bank who he's very close with, who he knows very well. He's already in a vegetative state for the last 4 or 5 years. Nothing is getting better. Nothing is getting worse. They have tried every medical intervention. And the doctors have given up. They said there's nothing more we can do. We're just going to continue to keep everything status quo. But the person could live for years and years like this. And his young wife, unfortunately, is an aguna, and she can't get remarried. And he cannot instruct anyone to give a get. He's in a vegetative state. So he came to Rabbi Avadi Yosef, the friend of his, and he said, you know, what do we do? So Maran Shlita, this is the son writing about his father. He came into the Beis Medrash and he asked the boys in the Yeshiva Chazon Avadia Sheyavo Asara LeBeit HaCholim that 10 people, a minion, should come with him to the hospital of where this person was. Bohu Me'ushbaz. V'yispalo Saviv Limitaso Seder HaTfila. And they should daven in a very particular order of tefillah around this bedside. Kidei Sheyamos. Rabbi Avadia brought a group of people from his yeshiva to the hospital and offered a tefillah that the person should die. Very brave thing to do. But that's what he did. Umaran atzmo, and says the son, my father himself, hishtatef imanu ba'osa ha'tefillah. My father didn't just send us, he came along with us, and he was the chazan. He was there with us, and he led the tefillah. Va'achin hisrakshas gedola achaznu ba. He said it was a very emotional experience. Here we are standing around the bedside of this person and offering a tefillah with all of our heart that he should pass away. So he says it was a very jarring experience. Be'ez ha'tfila imaran liyad mitas achola. There we were with my father. Everybody respects my father. We were standing around the bedside and davening that this person should pass away. Shaya adam tzayir umechuser hakara. And he says this young person was very young and had a young wife and a young family. And he was mechuser hakara. He had no understanding. At least as far as we knew, he was in a vegetative state. Va'achen, and he says, lo avarzman v'ha'ish nifta lebeis olam. He says, my father's tefillos were answered. And this man passed away. V'kach hutra ha'isha mikavle igunusa. And this woman was now freed from being chained up. This woman was no longer in aguna because now her husband passed away. So again, how exactly one should act in kind of situation is up for a major discussion. There are many who assume, like the Ran, that it is appropriate at some periods in one's illness that maybe you should daven that God should have rachmanis, that they should not suffer anymore, and that they should just pass away in peace, and they shouldn't have to deal with this anymore. There are others who argue that, no, the primacy of life is always the object that we're looking for, is always what we're going to consider the highest premium. That's a major question. And again, at what period in a person's illness do we assume you're up to that point where you can already start davening for this? Again, all of these things need to be thought about very carefully. But in general, it is inappropriate to offer a tefillah that someone should have a miracle being performed for them. So to ask for God to have rachmanis on the person and God will interpret whatever that means is one thing. But to ask outright that God should give a refuah to this person who the doctors say has no chance medically or in any natural means of really getting out of their illness is something that I believe is an inappropriate thing to daven for. So we spoke a little bit about tefillah for Echola. Again, next week I will be out of town, so we will not have a